Hi, everyone. I'm Cheryl Hoag with Chemical and Engineering News, and welcome to our session on shifting from a toxic legacy to a sustainable future. I'm glad you're here. We're going to have a really interesting discussion. Our speakers today, I'm going to start at the end, and this is the opposite way they'll be speaking, is David Wilkerson. He's the Corporate Director of Sustainability and Product Stewardship for Shaw Industries, which is, interestingly enough, a subsidiary of Berkshire Hathaway, which you may know from Warren Buffett. Shaw is the world's largest carpet producer and the carpet industry's largest recycler. Shaw recycles nylon from old carpets to make new carpets. And he is here representing the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council, which is a business forum that advances the application of green chemistry and design for the environment. Next to him is Ron Kendall, and he's no stranger to SEJ conferences. He was a key player in last year's conference at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. He is here speaking in his capacity as a professor in the Department of Environmental Toxicology at Texas Tech University. And next to me is Dan Fagan, and he's also well-known within SEJ. He's a former SEJ president and was a Newsday reporter. He's now an associate professor at New York University and director of its Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program. He's author of the book. Do you have your book with you, Dan?
Tomorrow. It will be in the... It'll be everywhere tomorrow.
Tom's River, a story of science and salvation. There's a speaker's list in the back on the chair by the door, if you'd like. And what I'd like to do is start with Dan and move down.
Great. Hi, everybody. Cheryl, thank you very much. Yes, I messed up and forgot to arrange for my book to be available, but it is coming tomorrow, and of course you can get it at your neighborhood bookstore, or even Amazon if you prefer. It's nice to be here. I look around the room and see some people I don't know, but a lot of people I do know and have been writing about toxic chemicals for a long time now, and I always kind of feel like we're talking a lot about the same issues, and I guess that's kind of inevitable because in some ways, at least on the regulatory sphere, we've made so little progress that the same old issues keep popping up. I wrote my book in part because I wanted to show that these issues are not necessarily arcane. They affect real people's lives. And I wound up writing a book about the saga, the sort of 50-year saga of what happened in one town that had a couple of big Superfund sites, and the sort of how events unfolded and how it was that problems that seemed so obvious and so horrendous in retrospect were not addressed contemporaneously. And I wrote the book in part because people like stories, and so I thought that this was a way to tell a story embedded in this larger issue of what do we do about these synthetic molecules, where our capacity to create has far exceeded our understanding of how these molecules affect living things. And I wrote it because I wanted to figure out a way to make these broader points. I feel like in some ways that, you know, this is not a chic issue. It hasn't been for a long time. Everybody wants to talk about climate or water or ocean acidification or what's new with particulate pollution, all these issues that are incredibly important. And the last thing I would want to do is to minimize those other issues. But this issue is still with us, and as journalists, I think it's really important for us to try really hard to figure out new ways to make people understand that these issues are really important. It's a pleasure to be up here with two people from one from academia and one from the industry that I'm sure are going to be talking a lot about green chemistry and about sort of what's next in terms of toxics. And I'm glad that they're going to do that. I mean, that's what the chemical industry likes to talk about, and it's quite interesting and quite important. I feel like I'm here maybe for a different reason, you know, which is to maybe talk about things that the industry doesn't necessarily want to talk about. And I want to touch on three issues that I think are really important for journalists to make sure that we don't lose sight of them. I got to say that Cheryl has been amazing over the years and just sort of making sure that we deal with both the legacy and regulatory questions while we're also thinking about innovation and green chemistry and coming up with better alternatives. So those three issues really quickly is that, you know, as great as green chemistry is, as responsive as the industry is being, and, you know, when there are new compounds under development to introduce, our biggest issue by far are the old high-volume grandfathered compounds. There's 60,000-plus grandfathered under TSCA. As you know, TSCA is a Model T of a law. It's a part per thousand law in a part per trillion world. Yes, but really, my fellow panelists are much better equipped to do so. But that's the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is really sort of the bedrock law for regulating toxics. It passed in 1976. Think about how long ago that was. And it has not been substantively changed since then. We still have this grandfathering issue. It is still a problem here in the United States. It's certainly a problem overseas where TSCA doesn't have regulatory effect, but it has people tend, at least until recently with the REACH program in Europe, people tend to defer to the U.S. regulatory regime. So the problems with TSCA are sort of ricochet all over the world. We got semi-close, I don't know, maybe not really that close, but there was at least talk, some serious discussion back and forth the last couple of years about updating this law, but it hasn't happened yet. It's, in my mind, it's very unlikely to happen in the coming year unless something's changed that I don't understand. Cheryl's a great person to answer that question. But we desperately need to change this law. We desperately need to deal with these grandfathered compounds. And interestingly, this is an area where this law is so bad that industry and environmentalists have some broad areas of agreement. They certainly do not agree on everything. You know, when David Vitter from Louisiana came onto the bill, a lot of environmental groups immediately left the bill. So it's going to be very difficult to actually get anything through the House and the Senate. But it is really important that we do something, and it's really important that journalists pay attention and don't just treat this as sort of a bureaucratic process, but a process that really affects people's lives. The second issue is that there's increasing evidence, scientific evidence, that we need to rethink our entire approach to toxicity screening. Because we have this regime that, you know, it's really even older than the 1970s. It's really a 1950s style regime that is based still on rodent bioassays. It's still very cancer centric. It's an incredibly outmoded way to be evaluating chemical risk. And yet, in the regulatory system, that's still what we use. In industry and academia, people are doing really interesting kinds of screens. But when it comes, you know, they're looking for hormonal effects. They're looking at dose response curves that are not necessary. They're non-monotonic. They might look more like roller coasters, where very low doses might have effects that are more damaging than higher doses. So there's lots of exciting stuff going on. Some of it makes for great stories, and yet none of it is reflected in the regulatory system, which really matters because that's how we determine what happens to these compounds. And thirdly, and very relevant to the Toms River book, which, by the way, will be on sale starting tomorrow afternoon. I'm just kidding, but it will be. The third issue, which is ultra important, is this question of legacy sites. You know, just like we have legacy grandfathered chemicals, we have legacy sites scattered all over this country, and believe me, there are new legacy sites being created in places like China and India every day. And we still have a very deficient way of addressing these places. Many sites never made it onto the National Priorities List, which is the federal government's list of the worst hazardous waste sites, the so-called Superfund list. And while the number of NPL sites is dropping as sites get delisted, which is wonderful, we have to remember that there are entire other classes of sites that never made it onto the NPL list because there were deliberate attempts to keep it off, to keep them off. These sites are now, enough time has passed that many of these sites are being actively redeveloped. We really need to make sure that they're being redeveloped as safely as possible. And because there's so little attention paid to Superfund anymore, that people sort of think of this as a problem that's kind of taken care of itself, it's sort of melted away, that there's opportunity for great mischief, I think, at specific sites for redevelopment. And that is a really important role of journalists to keep an eye on that. So I guess my role today is to say that while we're going to hear a lot about green chemistry and the importance of coming up with safer molecules, we also need to think about the world as it exists right now. And as the world exists right now, we're still doing 1950s-style testing under a 1976 statute using compounds, many of which were invented in World War II. And we still don't even have basic safety information, chronic human health information for a lot of them. So there's very fertile ground for environmental journalists out there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. Ron?
First of all, I wanted to thank Cheryl for inviting me today. And I think highly of you, Cheryl, and I couldn't resist when you wanted to talk about a chemical legacy and moving towards a more sustainable future. Quite frankly, this has been the most enjoyable meeting I've ever been to. It's the year after being responsible for a meeting, and now I just walk around and reflect on things instead of being the responsible party where Randy Loftus says, we got a problem, can you fix it? So I've enjoyed myself, and I decided just to speak to you today and discuss with you and not lecture to you. This subject is in my core because I reflect back on the whole. I'm an environmental toxicologist. What is that? That's a person that studies in toxicological perspective. What harms us and what doesn't? What are toxic levels and so on? And I tell you, it's a never-ending story. And our graduate students have fantastic job placement, but the bottom line is we are a modern chemical society. Whether you like it or not, every aspect of our lives are governed by modern chemistry. These iPads are full of chemicals. The seats you're sitting on are full of chemicals. The paints, I bet you they sprayed pesticide in here to kill the roaches. You drove over here on a bus or a car. We live in a chemical society. And I would suspect that none of you live in a cave with no heat, no running water, and so on. We live in a chemical society. The key is, how do we go forward and balance risk and benefit? That's what it's all about. How do we balance it so we have a sustainable future with a population on the planet that is incredible? So from my perspective with all of this, I look back in my heritage, in my interest in this, and to go back to the 60s, growing up in South Carolina on what we call the coastal plain, which is a very highly productive agricultural area, cotton, corn, tobacco. And guess what? All of those crops required an enormous amount of chemical control back then. There was the boll weevil, the tobacco budworm. I could go on and on. And that was the era where I became very interested in what we call the hard chemicals, DDT, dieldrin, heptachlor, toxaphene. I could go on and on. Then in the early 70s, I had the opportunity as a teenager to work in the laboratories of a world-renowned insect toxicologist. This was a team that was dedicated via USDA to looking at ways to control insect populations, particularly in cotton and so on. And there I was, a kid, having the opportunity at coffee time to listen and to once in a while be able to offer a perspective. You're talking about 1971. The conversation back then was, whatever it takes to kill them, we're going to kill them. Okay? That was it. If it takes 1 pound per acre, we'll do it. If it takes 2 pounds per acre, we'll do it. That's the level of application we used to talk about just in agricultural chemistry alone. And so as I went off the perspective that, well, if we're killing all the insects, what's it maybe doing to us? That's irrelevant. The theme was kill the target. I mean it. And so it started helping me develop a lot of my early professional philosophy is, what if? What if? What happens if it exposes us? What happens if it exposes fish and wildlife? And I had evidence that there was perhaps issues. But that's where we were in the early 70s and late 60s. And we exploded as a chemical society after World War II. This nation was humming industrially. We were producing chemicals at record paces. Then we moved into the 60s, and by the early 70s, we started creating new environmental laws. The Environmental Protection Agency was established. Dan talks about these archaic laws of TSCA, Toxic Substance Control Act, the Pesticide Control Act. We talk about the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. All of these things came into place because of the worryation in society as to the outcome of all of these chemical exposures. And I was caught up in all of that because the science just wasn't there. It was all hypothetical. Nevertheless, what is driving this transformation that we're talking about right now? A large part is environmental policy, whether you like it or not. I'm a scientist. I'm well published. I've had a lot of textbooks and very successful ones. My most recent, Wildlife Toxicology, Emerging Contaminant and Biodiversity Issues. But where's all this going? We are emerging as a society trying to balance our chemical needs with long-term sustainability in water, air, soil, and so on. And so I look back on our environmental policies. They drove a lot of our science. The science didn't necessarily drive the environmental policies. I served as chairman of the EPA Science Advisory Panel for pesticide issues. I can tell you the science was not driving the policies. The policies were driving the science. And so those laws, although archaic, set into motion a lot of the strategy to how to address these complex issues. Another issue is cost. The cost of this. What does it take to produce cotton, oil, tobacco, whatever is cost. And so as we look at environmental policy balanced with the underpinning of cost, we're seeing societal change. Okay? We're seeing changes in society because you want a high quality product for the less price, right? How are we going to get there? And so I look at back into the early 70s, the late 60s, we were using pesticides at pounds per acre. I know. I was working in the lab with these things. I handle DDT every day. So I know. Now we have emerged cost concerns, environmental policy concerns. We're using products today at ounces per acre. Is that right? I don't know. We're still trying to figure this out. And then in the 80s, we had the passage of the Food Quality Protection Act in 1986. That drove a whole new discipline of environmental endocrine disruptors. You've heard of that, okay? I was on that panel. It was called the Endocrine Disruptors Testing Advisory Committee as to how we would develop technology to understand not only how chemicals directly affect us, but maybe indirectly affect us through the endocrine system. Again, as we look at all of this background, we are evolving. We're trying to look at sensitive endpoints. We're trying to interpret these in ways that protect our health and our environment. And it's still evolving because the science isn't perfect. Toxicology is not perfect. Okay? I bet you after the reception last night, a lot of you went out, had some drinks. I know you SCJ people. I know you guys. This is my fourth meeting. I'm a veteran. So, see, with toxicology, everybody wants clear cut, black and white. Well, it's just not like that. Because some of you could drink all night and it would not, you'd be walking this morning. Others would have had one drink, went to sleep in your chair, and somebody had to take a taxi home. That's called toxicology. And if you want to talk about the biochemistry of that, meet me out in the hall. I can tell you all about it. But we're different. And that's why this is such a challenging perspective as we are going forward to find chemicals and processes that are more sustainable, that take less energy, that are recyclable, and that have societal acceptance, so we will buy it, use it, and perhaps reuse it. Okay? We weren't thinking like that in the 60s and the 70s. We began to think like that in the 80s and the 90s, and now we're seeing a major transition towards, potable water on the planet's limited. Can we pollute our air in a global scale? Yeah. Our knowledge base is changing, our capabilities are changing, but it's still an evolving spectrum. And that's why Cheryl, I accepted the invitation to come today, because I'm part of that evolution, as every one of us are in here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ron. So, David, I wanted to, first of all, I want to tell you that David was at SCJ Chattanooga 15 years ago, and I'm really excited that he could come again. And David, is this Shaw flooring, or is it of a lesser quality?
I'll take the fifth on that. I don't believe this is Shaw flooring, but there is some Shaw flooring in this building. I will say that. But I would like to start by thanking Cheryl for this opportunity to participate on this panel and be part of this SEJ conference. Just to give you a little bit of an overview about Shaw, and I'm going to touch on some things, and then if there are questions later, I'll dive into more detail. But Shaw is a large flooring manufacturer. We're based in Dalton. Not sure if all of you are familiar with Shaw, but we do happen to be the largest carpet manufacturer in the world. And as Cheryl mentioned, we're part of Berkshire Hathaway. We've been a wholly owned subsidiary since 2001, which has been a great experience for the company. But I would just mention that, you know, Shaw is very involved in carpet manufacturing, but we're also involved in other types of flooring. We are a very large manufacturer of hardwood flooring. We make laminate flooring, rugs, sports turf. We're involved in the sale of resilient flooring and ceramic and porcelain tile, as well as natural stone. So pretty much everything that's related to flooring, we're very involved with. We happen to be the largest manufacturing employer in the state of Georgia, which is something that we're proud of. And it's a company that I've been with my entire working career, so I have a lot of years of experience and can attest to, you know, what we do and what we believe. I think it's important, since this is a conference that's really focused on sustainability, I'll start by just commenting a little bit on our commitment to sustainability and to green chemistry. As Cheryl mentioned, we are a very active member in the Green Chemistry Commerce Council, commonly referred to as GC3. And that's a group of 70 member companies, and we discuss fairly frequently our experiences with green chemistry, best practices, and it's just a good collaborative organization to be a part of. But Shaw has really been on our sustainability journey for really a couple of decades. We have a very, very strong commitment to sustainability and green chemistry starting at the top. I think it's critically important if you're going to have a successful sustainability program that has long-term traction. It really has to begin with your CEO, with your senior leadership, and we're blessed at Shaw to have that. And we're also very actively investing in various types of sustainability initiatives. Many involve recycling. Some involve alternative energy. We're very focused on social responsibility. You know, we often talk about the triple bottom line of sustainability. A lot of companies do. Shaw certainly is in that group. But sometimes you boil that down to people, planet, profit. And we're very, very focused on all of the key components of sustainability. One of the things, and our focus is really holistic. It truly starts with the design of the products that we manufacture, that we transport to our customers. And, of course, there's a use phase. And then we have programs in place where we collect the post-consumer material and have recycling opportunities for that. And it's been a big investment for the company. It's a successful program. And, again, I can talk about that in more detail when we get to the question-answer session. But one of the things that really another thing that differentiates Shaw from the companies we compete with is the commitment we have to green chemistry and, more specifically, to cradle-to-cradle product design and manufacturing. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the term cradle-to-cradle. You're probably familiar with Bill McDonough, who is one of the champions, one of the thought leaders in the sustainability world, and his business partner, Michael Brungardt. They really collaborated back in the 90s and developed this cradle-to-cradle concept. But it really is a concept that's intended for manufacturers, and it's all about emulating nature. With the cradle-to-cradle protocol, I mean, you're really looking at how nature works and saying, you know, ideally, I design a product, produce a product, and ultimately reuse that product just like nature uses materials. If you think about it, there's no waste in nature. One of the components, one of the key components of the cradle-to-cradle concept is waste elimination and making products that are designed to be reutilized, making products that are safe. There's a concept or an idea, and then there's a certification program, which we are very, very involved with, have been for a number of years. In fact, we were the first flooring company in the world to actually certify flooring products under the cradle-to-cradle certification protocol. But, again, one of the big hurdles there starts with safe ingredients. And these materials that we use on the products that are certified have to be third-party assessed down to 100 parts per million, you know, 1/100th of 1%. So it's a deep dive. And all the materials utilized have to be deemed safe for humans and the environment, or you don't go any further. But after that, you know, if you clear that hurdle and you're working on certification, then you go to the material reutilization component, the use of efficient use of energy with a focus on renewable energy, water stewardship, and social fairness. These are all key components of the certification protocol. As I say, it's third-party and multi-attribute. So we're deeply involved in that. We can talk about some examples of recycling if you want to hear about that later. But, again, I would just close by saying that it's not a fad at Shaw. It's an overused cliche, but it truly is part of the company DNA. And I just don't see any chance of us deviating from our commitment to cradle-to-cradle product manufacturing and certification, using safe ingredients, and really embracing the fundamentals of green chemistry.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a question of each of the speakers, and then we'll open it to questions. David, I'm going to start with you. Sorry, I'll let you get some water there. What motivates companies like those in the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council to adopt safer chemicals and more sustainable products? How does this fit into your business goals? And isn't there still a lot of money to be made using what Dan calls the grandfather chemicals, the chemicals that have been with us for a long time, that may be toxic, to use the same old methodologies that they've been using for 50, 60 years?
Yeah. I think it varies from company to company. For us, it's really just fundamentally ingrained in our effort to be a good corporate citizen and do the right thing. I mean, we talked about sustainability and, you know, the components which involve environmental responsibility, social responsibility, and financial responsibility. We look at it and think from a long-term standpoint, if we're not setting an example as the leader in our industry, if we're not doing the right thing and providing leadership and investing in various types of innovative processes, we're not providing proper leadership, and we're not really ensuring a great future for our employees, and we're not effectively supporting our customers, who are our direct customers and consumers. So it sounds maybe, again, a little cliche-ish, but it really is all about doing the right thing and believing passionately about this is the right approach for our business.
Thanks. So, Dan, what do you think about good corporate citizens, and is there a better way that we can prevent more stories like Tom's River?
I like good corporate citizens. What I think about good corporate citizens is that we can't have a regulatory system that depends on good corporate citizens, which is in part what we have right now. Many people in corporations are doing excellent work, cutting-edge science. Many are definitely care about sustainability issues, and they get a lot of personal satisfaction out of moving the ball up the field toward sustainability. But a corporation fundamentally is an entity designed to maximize profit for its shareholders, and we can't possibly expect corporations not to do that. That's what they're for, and they do it well. So that's why we need a real regulatory system, robust, we need well-staffed agencies, and fundamentally we need legislation that reflects the current science, not 1970s level science. You know, every toxic type story that I've ever written, and I think I've written maybe 1,000, I don't know, many hundreds anyway, I've never once encountered somebody at a corporation who believes, or at least told me, that they were doing the wrong thing. No one ever thinks they're doing the wrong thing. These issues are complex. We're human beings. We tend to look for ways to justify our prior beliefs. And there's enough subtlety and uncertainty, as Ron was saying, associated with these issues that we can talk ourselves into just about anything. So there are very few people here that, in my experience, go into these issues trying to do the wrong thing. But that is not the point at all. You know, it is definitely important to inculcate sustainability into education and training. But even more important than that is to have a regulatory system that doesn't require that doesn't rely on people being good-hearted or people understanding what sustainability means. I'm thrilled to hear that Shaw is doing a lot of green chemistry. Over the years, the carpeting industry has had some significant problems, you know, with the use of glues especially, but also other kinds of legacy chemicals used in the manufacturing process and to give carpet beautiful color and durability, stain resistance. Legacy chemicals are involved in all of those processes. And I hope that Shaw is moving, as the industry leader, that Shaw is moving aggressively to look for better alternatives. The question, though, is whether anybody's forcing them to. And, you know, I think we need a regulatory regime that requires movement towards sustainability, and we really don't have that right now. It definitely should we need a regulatory regime that definitely takes economic impact into account, that recognizes, as Ron said, that there's always uncertainty in the science. But we also need a regime that keeps the pressure on, and we really don't have that right now. And until we do, there are always going to be more Tom's Rivers, and there are many, many more Tom's Rivers. The only thing that's surprising about what happened in Toms River is that we actually found out about it. And as I explain in the book, it just took a series of sort of fluky events that brought these issues, incredibly high exposures and terribly damaging consequences to human health that brought those issues to light. It took really terrible exposures and then really brave actions and a lot of luck. Brave actions by individuals and a lot of luck in order to bring these issues forward. Again, we can't rely on that. We need robust regulation. We need a robust public health system. And in the United States, in my view, we don't have that. Europe is moving toward a much more robust regulatory regime, and that's great. And a lot of the progress that we see is now driven by Europe, and that's a good thing. But I think we can do much better.
Thanks. Ron, you said that politics drove the science when it came to pesticide regulation. I'm wondering if you could explain what you meant by that, how politics drove the science, and whether that's still true. Is politics still driving the science?
You look at the Food Quality Protection Act of 1986.
That's 1996.
If you look at that as an example, did we have the science to pass that legislation? I don't know, probably not. It's been a lot of debate about it. But that legislation did precipitate an enormous research program to look at a variety of issues, including children exposure to toxic chemicals, to look at endocrine disruptor issues and so on. So I've just looked back over many, many years of when you're there as a professor looking for your next research grant, you realize and understand where the science is going and where new science is needed and what precipitates that. What became realistic to me as a scientist is that as we passed these new environmental laws, it took science to underpin them, okay? And that's what created a lot of driving force for new science. That became particularly evident to me when I was on the science advisory panel at the Environmental Protection Agency, ultimately chairing that panel for a number of years. And we were asked to advise the agency on the science to uphold environmental legislation. And that made me even further aware of how environmental legislation drove a lot of the scientific needs, because I would have panels with maybe 20 to 30 scientists come to the table and develop documents to recommend where the science needed to go. So looking back on this over many years, I was president of the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. It's a global network of environmental toxicologists. And I became very interested in how Congress developed science-based environmental legislation. I became very aware of the United States Senate Environment Public Works Committee, as well as the House Committee on Science and Technology. When I was president, I engaged both the Senate and the House to enter into their jurisdiction representatives from our organization, SeaTac. And we did get that done because I became aware how little information was integrated into our environmental laws and regulations. And I felt if they could have senior scientists from the professional organization of environmental toxicologists, they could do a better job. That was a successful interaction, but further, Cheryl, accentuated my understanding that the science doesn't necessarily drive the policies. It's public opinion, putting pressure on Congress. Congress will sometimes act without all the facts, so to speak. And here we go, the science trying to chase it. And I can further tell you, even since the passage of the Food Quality Protection Act, which I had to oversee a lot of that science generation during my tenure as a chair of the EPA science panel, because the EPA was coming to us constantly about advice of how to implement the Environmental Endocrine Disruption Program. Here we are all these years later, almost 20 years later, and we're still trying to implement it. I'm telling you, we're still trying to implement it. And so did the science of environmental endocrine disruptors facilitate the passage of that act with those caveats? No. We're trying to underpin it by the development of the science base as we go forward. Okay? Is that clear?
Great.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, now is the time for questions from members. And I ask that you identify yourself. We take the people with the blue badges first for the questions. So are there any questions for members? Over here, please.
I'm Susan Moran, a freelance journalist in Colorado. Maybe first question for Ms. For David. So it sounds like you have adopted as the company's policy for decades to do the right thing. How does it translate economically? I mean, could you talk about some of the trade-offs between the right thing in terms of sustainability and if you're a private company?
Yeah. Well, we're part of Berkshire Hathaway.
Okay, I need to repeat the question, which is how do companies do this, and what are the trade-offs economically and for sustainability? Is that right? Okay.
We are private to an extent. We're part of Berkshire Hathaway. So we used to be a publicly owned company until 2001, which is when Berkshire bought Shaw. The record is very clear. We have, for as long as we've been a major manufacturer and public company, we were the most profitable flooring manufacturer and carpet manufacturer in the industry. Today, we continue to be the most profitable, even though the numbers aren't publicly identified. They are built into the Berkshire reports. I would contend that there has been no adverse impact associated with our commitment to, you know, whether it's doing the right thing or green chemistry. I mean, we also invest heavily back into our business through capital expenditure. We are a low-cost producer. We, in the carpet industry, we are the low-cost producer. And it's not necessarily attributable to any one decision, but the bottom line is we do have extremely efficient, safe manufacturing processes, and we make very safe products. I would also just comment on, Dan said something about legacy chemicals. I'm not really sure which specific chemicals that he was referring to, but for at least the last 15 or 20 years, there really hasn't been any issues around the product itself. There are some urban legends about asthma, allergy, and things of this nature. But as far as chemicals themselves, I don't know if you had one that you were thinking of.
What do you use for your adhesives these days?
Well, they're all formaldehyde-free, if that was where you were headed. I'm not sure. There hasn't been formaldehyde used in carpet adhesives for at least 20 years.
Domestically, but not...
Anywhere we sell it. I mean, it's just not part of the process. Another thing I would stress... Residentially, which is 70 or so percent of our business, you don't glue carpet down routinely. It's stretched. It's installed without adhesive. Commercially, there are a number of instances that require adhesive where you glue the material to the subfloor. But again, for many, many years, at least 20, there has been no formaldehyde. And for the last 5 to 7, there have not been any solvents that have been used. It's water-based adhesives. They do pass very, very strict VOC emission tests that are really driven by California 1350 statute. And, we have our own industry certification protocol that ensures that, I mean, carpet, just not to dwell on carpet because we make all types of flooring, but since that's the one that is on the table, it truly is one of the lowest emitting building materials that you could have in any residential or commercial building. So, I'll leave that and go on. But I'm not sure if I really answered your question.
It's okay for now. I want a little more specifics. Like the interface, mm-hmm. Remember Ray Anderson years ago saying, it's great, we're trying to do good, that is our commitment, but it's not good economically. And I thought the case before you sold
Berkshire
was kind of similar.
No. You can go back and look at the record, but Shaw was for many years sort of a darling of Wall Street. I mean, if you look at the stock price, as an example, from the early 80s till, say, the late 90s, I mean, it would go up and split and go up and split. I mean, if you bought Mr. Bob Shaw, who's now retired from Shaw Industries, used to use an analogy, if you had bought $10,000 worth of Shaw stock in 1980 and sold it in 98, I believe was the year, it'd be worth about $8 million. I mean, it was a huge run-up. So, but again, it was indicative of the success the company had and our commitment to our customers and to the industry and providing leadership throughout that time. I don't think there was, even during the deepest recession in living memory, prior to the Great Recession, I mean the Great Depression, when the industry, the flooring industry was off 40%. If you look at 2006 to 2010, we had dramatic, this is not just carpet, this is a result of the U.S. economy being in such difficulty. We remained profitable throughout that period. We did have to change the size and the scope of some of our operations. We, unfortunately, because business was off, we did have to downsize some plants. But during this period, we were also investing in new technology that would be preparing us for the upturn, which we're starting to experience now.
Okay. Great. Other questions here? Jenny? Okay. The question is about the top level issues in green chemistry and who's doing them.
The chemical industry has changed dramatically over the last 30 years. In fact, if you look back over it, there are just a few players left, say in the agricultural chemical industry that existed 30 years ago. There has been an enormous change. And the challenges are, number one, produce viable products that have less impacts to the environment and human health, but still achieve pest control or other control or improvement strategies. It'd be cost effective, and it'd be accepted by society. And these days, it does make good business sense to be green, okay? That's a corporate strategy. And rightfully so. I mean, corporations have to make money, and if they don't, they can't keep their employees and they can't stay in business. So as I look at the chemical industry, take Bayer Crop Science. They are 20 years ahead in using genetic technology to develop cotton plants that require less chemical control, that require less water, that grow faster, produce more fiber, and better fiber. So these plants of the future will be less dependent on chemicals and more dependent on the germplasm, okay? And they're not genetically necessarily engineered. They're selecting for characteristics that are innovative, that are cutting edge, that builds on modern biology, okay? So that's just one example of a total change of thinking. As I told you, that cotton plant 30, 40 years ago, they were going to put however many pounds per acre they needed to control whatever pest, and that's it. The heck with everything else. Now, the strategy is you've got to be very careful about water pollution, about site contamination, drift. All of these questions come in to the overall risk. And as I said, we're trying to achieve benefits from these chemicals, whether it's flooring or whether it's cotton production or whatever, at the same time minimizing risk. That's all. That's every day. When you get on a plane or get in a car to drive out of here, you're taking a risk. But you're going to achieve a benefit. You're going to get home. Okay? And it's all about weighed risk and minimizing risk and trying to achieve benefits. So I can tell you, those industries that saw the future, seriously, and became visionary of green chemistry, these technologies, I can tell you, the pesticide industry, there's only a handful left, and they were the visionaries. The Bayer Crop Science, as an example. Okay?
I can give you an example. It's... I think, pretty easy to get your head around. If you go back, you know, I talked about our commitment to cradle product design and manufacturing and certification. If you go back to the early days of that decision at Shaw and that initiative, we were making carpet tile. I'm not sure if you're familiar with carpet tile as a product category, but it's extremely popular today in the commercial space. Carpet tile in offices, educational areas, even in hospitality. I mean, it's just becoming a very, very popular flooring. And it's carpet in squares and rectangles. Well, back in the 90s, we've been involved in that business. We're involved in all types of flooring product categories, but carpet, as I said, is our biggest. Carpet tile is a category that's primarily focused on the commercial marketplace. But we were involved in that business. Back in that period, everything that was made in carpet tile by us and by our competitors, and it was mentioned Interface, big competitor in that one category. All they make is carpet tile. We're a bigger company, but we make, you know, we compete in a lot of different areas. But we were a competitor. We were a manufacturer of carpet tile. And in those days, everything that was used, all of the carpet tile backing was made with PVC and phthalates. The phthalates, think of that as a lubricant that made the PVC pliable, flexible. But and we were making that product. As we began to learn more about some of the health risks associated with PVC and phthalates, our senior management basically gave us a challenge. And the challenge was to invent a better mousetrap, develop a product that did not utilize PVC or phthalates, and at the same time could be endlessly recycled without any degradation of quality, and throw another monkey wrench in there, make the product better from a performance standpoint than what we and our industry competitors had been making. Well, it didn't happen overnight, but we introduced a product that we call EcoWorks in 1999, and we introduced it alongside the other products that we had been making, and we allowed our customers to make a decision, to make a choice. We priced it the same, even though our cost was a little higher at the time on the EcoWorks platform, but it eliminated the use of PVC and phthalates. We substituted or transitioned into a polyolefin compound that is endlessly recyclable, that does not have in some of these chemicals of concern. And the market immediately began to gravitate to that. I mean, it truly was an invention, or that alternative. Within 3 years, we were able to totally eliminate, discontinue the use of the PVC products and focus 100% of our energy and efforts on the EcoWorks backing system. I think that innovation has led to Shaw being today the largest carpet tile manufacturer in North America. We have also just opened a plant in China that will allow us to penetrate the Asian market, where there is a significant demand for carpet tile products, but to make them in the United States and ship over there and try to compete with the local manufacturers, the time delays, it's not the cost so much as it's the time delays associated with manufacturing and transportation, kept us from being as successful as we thought we could be. So we've invested in a plant that's just recently opened. But the other point that I would make about that product category is not only was it PVC and phthalate free, it was also dematerialized. We were able to take about 40% of the weight out of that product, so the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the transportation were far less. The actual, I'll call it environmental footprint associated with making the product compared to the original product we made was also much less. And we have since invested in some very extensive recycling capabilities that allow us to have a international environmental guarantee, whereas we put a toll-free number and a website address on the back of every tile that we produce. And at the end of that product's useful life, we encourage that end user or whoever's taking the material up to get in touch with us. We will bring the material back and recycle it at our expense because it has value to us. When we engineered the product, it did have materials that we had determined could be endlessly recycled without degradation of quality. Keep in mind, the product, as I mentioned, was superior to the product generation of product we had been producing. And today we have a steady stream of material coming back for closed-loop recycling, and we've invested in a nylon depolymerization plant, basically a nylon recycling plant, where we basically segregate the materials, we recycle the backing into more backing, we recycle the fiber into more fiber. And it's a very sophisticated, complicated process, but we process about 100 million pounds a year of material in that plant.
Okay, great. I also wanted to say, Jenny, just as an observer of this, who's doing a lot of the green chemistry, there are maybe three or four classes, and that's entrepreneurs, chemists who want to make a better mousetrap and make, you know, it's green chemistry on both ends, green as in environmental and green as in money. Academics are also working on this. There's small companies that, small chemical companies, we don't think about those sometimes. There's just boatloads of them. And then there's people like DuPont who wants to make money in the future. They phased out their CFCs and they made money and they're making money on their what they're replacing those compounds with as well too. There was a question over here. I thought hand. Oh, right here. Go ahead, please. Identify yourself. Can we get to the question? Okay. Can we get to the question, please?
So that's the question is, what were the problems with the system that we couldn't improve in this law, or come up with other laws that were following more or less the same type of system that now Europe is actually using a lot?
Okay, so this is about what I guess internationally would be called pollution release systems. We have the toxics release inventory here in the United States. Dan, do you want to take that?
Sure. Yeah, there was a vogue, I guess you could say, of right to know TRI type laws starting in the 80s. California, as usual, led the way, and there has since been a lot of blowback, principally from industry, but also from regulators who saw that these right to know laws were very difficult to implement. The national right-to-know stuff, there are huge gaps in the toxic release inventory, for example, that the EPA has only gradually started to fill in. I don't know whether utilities are still exempt from TRI or not, but they were.
Some of them are.
Yeah, some of them are in anyway. Mining is another one, a huge, huge gap, a huge exception. So, you know, personally, I think right to know is a really good mechanism. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion now about how to handle genetically modified organisms, and you know how much disclosure should be associated with GMOs. And I feel really torn about that personally. I just wrote an editorial for Scientific American about that. In which I regretfully came to the conclusion that mandatory disclosure of GMO content in food is probably not a good idea because it doesn't really give consumers toxicologically useful information. It's a whole nother topic, but I'm unconvinced by the evidence of harm, generally speaking, associated with GMO content. And so, therefore, I guess what I'm saying is that right-to-know laws are great in a general sense, but they do need to have scientific data behind them, and they need to be carefully written in order to spell out who's covered, who isn't, and what exactly we're disclosing when we disclose. Generally speaking, though, I do think they can be really useful. And I remember when TRI started in the 1980s or 1990s. I don't remember when it kicked in, but 88. Thank you, Cheryl knows all. She's amazing. She's like a walking toxics encyclopedia. Yeah, a very charming one. When TRI kicked in, we all would write stories about the 10 biggest emitters in our circulation area if we worked for a newspaper like I did. And it had a wonderful effect that those industries would try really hard not to be on that list next year. Sometimes the things they did were not really legitimate reductions. Or they would find a way to game the system. But generally speaking, they were positive. So I guess to summarize my very long answer, RTK laws have lost a lot of their political support because regulators tend not to like them and industry does not like them at all. Just the general, the air has sort of come out of this issue. Environmentalists are just not as excited about toxic issues as they were in the 1980s. They're more focused in other areas, including GMOs. So I don't see a lot of forward progress at all, on mandatory disclosure laws.
Okay. Jim? So the question is, can you tell the difference between green chemistry and greenwash? And are there any organizations that actually do this? I'll take a little stab at this. And I will tell you at first, my paycheck is from the American Chemical Society, which is a scientific society, and as part of the American Chemical Society is the Green Chemistry Institute. It's academic. They don't do... They're not taking any sides except they think green chemistry is really good. That's probably a good source for that kind of stuff. But understand that they do have a lot of industry ties, so they're not going to probably trash industry. I don't know if anybody else would like to take a stab at that. How do you tell the difference between green chemistry and green? Okay, Ron, then Dan.
That's a good question, Jim. But... David brought us information about the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council, and I'm very familiar with SC Johnson as an example, and I know their director of toxicology, Dr. Pat Guiney. And SC Johnson produces a lot of the products that you use every day, like Windex, Pledge, and so on. And Dr. Guiney heads up their toxicology unit, so if you to look at green list versus green wash, you got to learn and know a little bit about toxicology. You got to understand what they're trying to do and what in the context of being more green. But right now, as part of this initiative that Shaw Industries is part of, green chemistry and commerce, SC Johnson has reformulated their RAID amp powder, where it had a zero rating earlier on the green list. They reformulated it, removing the use of the insecticide Propoxer. And then the reformulation of the product Windex, glass cleaner to remove a solvent and removing most of the volatile organic compounds and increasing the cleaning powder. So I can go on and on. They reformulated Pledge, which is, to clean dust. And they reduced volatile organic chemicals. and increase the cleaning powder. And you can go to those formulations, and if you know a little bit about chemistry and toxicology, you can see it for yourself. Because there are a lot of rating processes now that identify bad actor chemicals. And like SC Johnson, they are an organization that's family-owned, from my recollection, and they've been in the business a long time. They try to be high integrity, and it makes good business sense to move towards green chemistry. And these are examples of them doing it, being overseen by people like Dr. Pat Guiney, the immediate past president of the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. So there is a sense to this, and I think if you're in the business, and as I mentioned earlier, I've watched so many of what used to be leadership in the pesticide industry fall out. They're gone. They're just gone, and only a handful are left. And why did they make it? It's because they had to be innovative. They had to be tactical. And I think they had to move towards credibility, public acceptance that for their products, and producing products that were more green, Jim. I really mean it. And it's kind of hard to hide it. It's either there or not, because you could call up a toxicologist if you couldn't do it and get a read on it in a hurry, these products. That's what you could do. It's just find some people in the Louisville area that you could reach out to at the University of Louisville, and I could tell you in a hurry, is that product moving towards green or not, based on its toxicology and its environmental chemistry, how long it's going to remain in the environment, will it be picked up by aquatic organisms and so on. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Jim is basically asking, just to repeat the question, Jim is asking that they may be changing their, in some cases they're changing process, but the, what the consumer actually receives doesn't change that much, and sometimes it's the opposite. And how do you really know? And I maybe Ron will answer this too, but in my experience, it is not as easy as Ron explained it, that it is not at all easy to get certification groups to say anything negative about a particular product. What I used to do when I did this, and what I did with my book too, is that I would look not to certification groups, which I think tend to be pretty greenwashy. They tend to be pretty PR oriented. I look more to competitors, and have usually off the record conversations with competitors about what are you doing, and here's what these guys say that they're doing, and where does that fit in? And if you can establish a relationship of trust with the competitors, you can actually get really useful information, because no one really knows better than the people in that particular sector what's possible and what isn't. So I used to, and still do to some extent, really try to identify the key competitors and talk to them, because I have not found the certification groups to be particularly helpful. They're really great in a general sense at just sort of explaining, what our goals are and why green chemistry is important. But in terms of actually evaluating specific processes and calling out specific companies, they really tend not to do that. The second specific piece of advice that I would have is, look to California and look to REACH in Europe. There's a lot of information that's now online, a lot of good database stuff that, depending on the sector and the chemical involved, can be really, really helpful. And again, probably more helpful than the industry green chemistry groups, which are great for just sort of setting out general goals and trying to understand what green chemistry is and why it's important, but tend not to be very helpful in my experience in calling out individual companies.
I don't know.
Or processes?
Yeah, or processes. I mean, do you not agree with that, Ron?
No comment.
Okay, that's our last question.
Hi, Ron.
Hi, Randy.
So this is about the kind of the evolution of toxicology, would you say, Randy, and about finding about things that we thought were okay and suddenly, uh-oh.
Yeah,
what's on your watch list, Ron?
That's a good one. We'll go back to the tenets of toxicology. Paracelsus told us that the dose makes the poison. Literally anything can be toxic if you eat, drink, or breathe enough of it, including water. You know, you can kill yourself drinking too much water. Now, people don't understand that sometimes, so the dose makes the poison. You know, as we look into the future, we are, in my opinion, I told you, a lot of the chemical industry that doesn't exist today wasn't innovative, and I saw it for fact. They dropped out. And I do believe there is a commitment and an interest in industry to try to find those products that are safer. They are safer for the environment and safer for our health. And if you don't do that, you probably won't be around. And that's why 20 years ago, Shaw dropped formaldehyde. Formaldehyde's bad for you. I know. I lived in a mobile home as a PhD student at Virginia Tech with a formaldehyde-treated fluorine and all, and it was pretty rough on me. I got through, but it was rough on me. I realized now that it was affecting me. So as I look to the future, Randy, we are looking at all kinds of new products, and we're trying to derive new chemistry. Some very interesting things are occurring. The neonicotinoid pesticides, very minute quantities are being used, yet they're so targeted that maybe at certain pest control, yet at the same time they have indirect effects that we would have never conceived, as an example. And the whole bee controversy, there's questions on birds, et cetera. And it's just, again, the unfolding of these new technologies. Some new products developed by DuPont that were highly selective herbicides. And it turns out they were so powerful that if you got them even near a conifer, they were killing them, although they may be good for other components of golf course control or et cetera. So what I'm saying to you, this whole unfolding event of trying to find better and more focused chemistry is, you know, it's a challenge. And I think these companies, I think DuPont is trying to find great technologies for the future. And I think companies, as I mentioned, Bayer Crop Science, they're trying to not just look at chemistries, but look at that whole crop ecology issue. It's not just how to pound an insect with a chemical, but how to challenge him using germplasm and the plant's ability to evolve to deal with that pest with maybe some help from certain strategic chemistries. So from my side, we look down the road and we're becoming as much a chemical society as we were 30, 40 years ago. We're more. And a lot of these newer products and technologies that are coming on, it's difficult for us to test everything under every situation. Okay. And so we've got to be...
I'm sorry, we are down to the wire here. But I'll let you finish up here, Ron.
So from my side, Randy, environmental toxicology, will be around until we aren't around, because it's all unfolding. And that, in the context of changes in climate issues, changes in our use of water, it's all these things. They integrate. It's not just one thing. It's what I'm trying to get across. It's a whole combination of issues, and it's complex, and it's a neat field to be in, because you never will end with the questions.
Okay. Also, I'll say that chemists really like to invent things, but they don't always, and they're really cool and they work really well, but they don't always look at all the implications or the toxicology. Dan has a quick point, and then,
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to suggest, Randy, that it's not just about a new molecule, but it's also often very much about a new use or a ubiquity of exposure. And so I would look to see the industrialization of the rural landscape via hydraulic fracturing, that, you know, there are going to be new kinds of exposures, and therefore we're going to be seeing new, you know, epidemiology is going to come into play in ways that it has not in the past as these exposures become more ubiquitous. And, you know, we're going to see things that we did not anticipate, especially as some of the more arcane fracking fluids are disclosed. So that's coming too.
Okay. Will you join me in thanking our speakers?